Hi, I'm Sam Jakubowski from the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club, and you're listening to Extended.
This is XTP Media.
There's this incredible flexibility that they showed, and that really is what stopped South Korea from being completely and utterly annihilated, really. Yeah, well, there's a story to this, because actually there are three different events that could be the first air-to-air kill.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. And we're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 114 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. And today, our guest is retired fast jet and airline pilot and internationally acclaimed author Michael Napier, and we're going to talk about his latest book, The Korean Air War: Sabres, MiGs and Meteors, 1950 to 1953. Mike, welcome to Extended.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Peter. It's great to be here, and thanks for the kind invitation to join you all.
I'm delighted to have you here. I'm surprised we actually haven't talked to you on the show already, actually, given, the pedigree I described earlier. There's so much to talk to you about. But before we talk about the Korean War, for those who don't know about Michael Napier, can you tell us about your aviation background, please?
Yeah, I can. It started a frighteningly long time. Well, in fact, I guess it started as a kid, because I was like most pilots. I was the kid who wanted to be a pilot when I grew up, but never quite managed to grow up. So it's been going on that long. Yeah, frighteningly long time ago, I joined the RAF. And so I spent the back end of the 1980s and the front end of the 1990s flying Tornado GL1s out of Bruggen in Germany, which was fantastic fun. And in the middle of that, I did a tour flying the Hawk as well, instructing at the Tactical Weapons Unit. And then after a bit of time on the ground, I left the RAF in 97, joined British Airways, and have had an enjoyable second career flying a bit of long haul, did DC-10, 777, then I did a bit of short haul for on the Airbus 320, and then finished off a couple of years on the 787, and then knocked it on the head a couple of years ago, having thought, well, do you know what, I'm still alive. And but in the meantime, I got into writing books, not bestsellers, I have to say, but, you know, into that little niche of sort of military history. Yeah. Or military aviation history, should I say. And, I sort of managed to well, do some quite interesting little bits and pieces and build a bit of a following and I guess a bit of a reputation for hopefully producing some quite sort of good quality stuff that people have found interesting to read. And that, I guess, is why we're here, ultimately, is the latest one about the good old Korean War.
Yeah. Well, I just let me backtrack, Mike, because I will have to come and talk to you another day about the DC-10.
Oh yeah,
because it's my favorite airliner, so we're going to park that one. I'd love to come back and talk to you about your airline career in particular, so thanks for that. I didn't know about the DC-10. I knew about some of the more recent aircraft, but there you go, you got me now. But it's a great book. It's very attractive. It's real quality, and you know what, it's a heavy book, so when you pick it up, it's 300 pages. There's pictures on every page. I couldn't quite work out, Mike, whether it's a coffee table book or a reference book or a bit of both.
Yeah, I think it's, as you say, I mean, as an author, you write a book, you send off a manuscript, you're not quite sure what's going to come back. And sometimes what comes back isn't quite what you expected. But this one, I have to say, you know, I'm actually, the guys at Osprey have done a fantastic job. And it's, it is an attractive book. And it fits into any of those genres, really. You stick it on your coffee table if you like. But it, ideally, you know, it's a, It's a book that I would say it is a reference book, but it's also one that I hope people can read and then see things of interest, because what I hope to have done is to put everything kind of in perspective. We're jumping ahead of ourselves here, I know, but I mean, that's one of the reasons why I went into it, is because when I started in looking at it, the Korean War, for a different reason, I have to say, I thought, well, I need to read about the subject. And what I found was there was nothing around that gave you the overview, that gave you everybody's point of view, because you can buy a book or numerous books which tell you what the US Air Force got up to. You can buy a book or numerous books on what the US Navy got up to, or the Marines, the Australian Air Force, but nobody's pulled all of it together. Yeah. And I thought, well, somebody's got to do that. You go, and it's the old thing, yeah, if you want a job done, do it yourself. So that's basically that's basically what I've done.
What kicked off that interest in the Korean War then? What were you looking for? Was it just interest? Because it is one of those conflicts that, to be absolutely honest, is a little bit of a forgotten one.
Well, it's a completely forgotten one, really. I've always been in the back of my mind, and as I say, perhaps because I could never find a book that covered everything, it sort of didn't go very much further than that. But a few years ago, I was writing or researching a book on the operational history of the RAF, which came out sort of for the centenary year. And as I bounced through that, we got to 1950 exactly, and Korean War kicks off. Well, I knew that the Air Force wasn't particularly, or the RAF wasn't particularly involved in it, other than the flying boats, the Far East Air Force. So I knew they got Sunderlands involved. But then when I started doing a bit more digging, I suddenly discovered there was a whole raft of RAF pilots who'd flown operational missions with the American forces, particularly the US Air Force, but also the US Marines, and also with the Australian Air Force. And that's really where the interest came. And I started delving around and got quite a lot of information. And that's actually where that sort of subtitle of Migs, Meteors and Meteors came from, Sabres, Migs and Meteors, because I'd started looking at it and thinking, wow, yeah, what a really interesting thing as I got into it. And then I bounced the idea off the publisher's Osprey, and they said, well, what we really need, as I say, is one on the whole war. And I'd already sort of come to that conclusion myself. So that's where it all came from, really. But it was that interest of all these guys who are now completely forgotten, who had actually, flown operational missions over Korea, and then everybody's forgotten about it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, actually, it's a really interesting story. And the more that I got into the Korean War, the more I realized there's so many facets of it and so many really interesting bits and pieces about it. And particularly when you start pulling in the Russians and the Chinese and God knows who else as well. Yeah. I mean, it's a massive subject, and one, as I say, of which there are so many angles and little bits and pieces where you go, wow, that's interesting. So,
Well, there is, and the book's got a blow-by-blow account of every element of all the engagements. But just to put it into context, what was the background to the conflict, and how did the various air forces come into it? What was their structure coming into this air war?
We'll just have a quick 2 minutes worth of global history. But basically, if you think of that corner of the Far East, so you've got China, Japan and Russia all close together, and if you think of it as sort of go back to GCSE maths as a Venn diagram, the little circle, or the bit of the circle that's in all three of those, is Korea. So, of course, whenever the Chinese, Russians, and Japanese had punch-ups, it all happened in Korea. And that's particularly the case of the Sino-Japanese War at the back end of the 1800s, the Russo-Japanese War at the beginning of the 1900s. And at that stage, the Japanese thought, sod it, we keep having wars here, we might as well own the place. So they took it over. So what you ended up with when World War II kicked off was at the there was the Japanese run Korea. There was up in the north of the country, particularly, there were the Chinese communist backed guerrillas who were fighting a guerrilla war against the Japanese, amongst whom was a guy called Kim Il Sung. And over in Shanghai, in nationalist China, there was a guy called Sung Man Rhee, who was the who ran the kind of democratic government of Korea that was recognized outside. So right from the start, there was it was all very unstable, and there were these two different sort of governments that both of which Kim Il Sung and Sung Man Rhee claimed ownership of the whole place. And at the end of World War II, the Russians having beaten the Japanese came from the north, and the Americans having beaten the Japanese came from the south, and they met on the 38th parallel, shook hands and said, right, we'll stop here. And then they set up their own puppet governments, as it were, of these two characters. But both Kim Il-sung and Syng Man Rhee, as I mentioned, thought that they were the sole rightful governors of the whole of Korea. And it was Kim Il-sung who actually took the initiative. And in 1950, he thought, right, here's my great opportunity. The Americans, the Russians had already left, and the Americans thought, right, we might as well go home now as well. And at that stage, old Kim Il-sung thought, right, the Yanks have gone home. If I invade now and get it all over and done with in a couple of weeks, they won't come back and the job's done. And that's basically what happened. So in the summer of 1950, this snap invasion happened, and very, very, very nearly actually did take over the whole of Korea. But you asked about the air forces, and so let's start with dear old Kim Il-sung. He, because he knew that he was going to go on the offensive, as it were, he actually got a very efficient and very effective little air force going. I think mainly run by guys who'd been in the Imperial Japanese Air Force, and he got a regiment of Ilyushin 10 Sturmovik ground attack aircraft. Very successful aircraft from the Russians used on the Eastern Front.
Yeah.
And he got Yak-9Ps, which is like a sort of Spitfire ski, one might call it. So yeah. Quite effective piston-engined fighters. And he got two regiments of these. So what's that, sort of 30 to 40 airplanes. He got some more underway. He only didn't have that many pilots, though. And so from the Air Force perspective, him invading South Korea in 1950, the Air Force was fairly limited in terms of how many people it got. Also, those two aircraft are quite short range as well. So, but in terms of actually providing battlefield cover, while things were quite static, he was actually well-placed. The Republic of Korea, however, the South Koreans had nothing. Their air force was tiny. It had, I think, a couple of spotter type planes.
Yeah.
They had some Harvard trainers. Oddly enough, Syng Man Rhee had asked for some F-51 Mustangs to be supplied, and the Americans turned around and looked at it and thought, well, we won't do that because we don't want to sort of increase any tensions there. So there might be a war, that you might decide to invade the North, so we won't do it.
Yeah.
So that was that. The nearest sort of air forces were the American Air Force or the Far East Air Force, which was based in Japan, and also the Soviets had they owned Port Arthur, which now in these days is called Dalian, or rented it from the Chinese. So they had an Air Force sort of piston engine aircraft there. But they also had, because the nationalists from Taiwan, or Formosa, whatever it's called then, were bombing Shanghai, they had been asked to send some fighters in to help stop that. So they'd sent some MiG-15s in. So there's a regiment of MiG-15s up near Shanghai who, first of all, stopped the Taiwanese from bombing Shanghai, but then were given the job of training the Chinese Air Force. Chinese Air Force didn't exist before 1949.
Wow.
So when the war kicked off in summer of 50, the Chinese Air Force was probably about 9 months old. So if you think they started from absolutely nothing, in a country of how many million, largely agricultural peasants, and then 3 years later, they were fighting whole regiments of MiG-15 jet fighters. I mean, that's one of the amazing stories, I think.
Yeah. Those early first combats, combat engagements, didn't involve the jets, did they? They were predominantly piston.
That's right. In fact, we would jump because I say the American Air Force. So basically, there's this Air Force in based in Japan, and everybody's on the wind down. So these guys are stuck there. They probably want to get home. There's some B-29s in Okinawa. There's some B-26s, which are very old and knackered. There are some F-80 Shooting Star jet fighters, which are new, and the guys there are hugely into being fighter pilots, going off and fighting each other. So they've never really done any bombing. Haven't worked with the army at all. And the F-80 is quite a short-range airplane, so it's great for getting airborne from somewhere near Tokyo, doing a dogfight and coming home again. There also, there's a squadron of night fighters there, which are twin Mustangs, F-82s, really weird-looking machine, looks like two Mustangs stuck together.
Amazing.
And that's what... So when the war the invasion kicked off, the Americans weren't actually part of what was going on, but they had lots of military advisors and their families living in Seoul. So they said, right, we need to get these guys out, and... they sent a ship there And then they sent some airplanes, transport airplanes as well. And they said, right, we need obviously need to give these guys cover to make sure that the North Korean fighters don't try and attack them. So the only airplane that could reach that far at that stage was the twin Mustang, the F-82. So these guys who were sort of night fighter pilots suddenly found themselves being long-range escort pilots. Yeah. And indeed, as you mentioned, one day the Korean fighters had set off to see what they, try and take names and kick ass, and came across a pair of F-82s and thought, right, we'll have them. Fortunately for the Americans, I guess, they're able to turn the table. So these guys, although they were effectively 19 interceptor pilots, and managed to take on these these single engine fighters and shot a couple of them down. So that was the first few engagements was that.
Right, okay. And one of the things that struck me in the early stages of the war was, as the Americans entered the fray, was the use of, you mentioned the B-29s,
yeah,
and the B-26, was almost that back to the Second World War heavy bombing type approach to try and push the North back. But it caused all sorts of problems with the land forces, and particularly with the American land forces, didn't it? Because they just weren't very well coordinated.
Well, that's right. Well, the first thing, again, worthy of mention, is that the USAF, I mean, we talked about the Chinese Air Force starting in 1949, the USAF actually only started in 1948. No, they didn't. They were in the same war. No, I say that was the U.S. Army Air Force. So the first thing that happens in 1948 is we have the independent USAF. And, of course, all the guys who run it are ex-Army generals, although they've been obviously specialists in the Air Force. But also all the Army generals fighting the ground war or roundabout are really quite angry, thinking, well, hang on, this should be Army. And therefore making life unbelievably difficult in the same way. To an extent, the services did to our own RAF when that got independent. But so you're right, and so you end up with China circles trying to sort of because they know that the Army is doing its best to embarrass them to basically just score political points, and they're doing their very best to try and meet all the tasking possible. But also you get the Army saying, well, we'll do the tasking for you and tell you what you can attack. But of course, these are Army guys now who don't understand Air Force, so they look at a B-50 or a B-29 and go, well, that's a big bomber, we need people to drop lots of bombs, we'll have one of those. Little understanding that it's a sort of strategic war in that the crews are trained to bomb big cities from 40,000 feet, not bomb a guy in a truck from 5,000 feet. That was the massive difficulty. The other thing, of course, was in that beginning that the front was moving back so quickly because the Korean army, basically, there wasn't much of it, collapsed virtually, and the North was surging forward. And the only thing that could stop them was American air power. So these guys, again, who in their F-80s, who'd spent their whole time fighting each other sort of near Tokyo, suddenly found themselves doing an hour's transit, drop down, short of fuel, find a tank, bomb it, turn around, come home again. But that was basically how the North Korean advance was eventually was slowed down and eventually stopped back in the Busan perimeter down in the southeast of the country. And it was basically American air power and an incredible, I have to say, the thing that really I admire about the USAF was how professional and how flexible they were. That the F-82 night fighter pilots became day fighter pilots, the F-80 day fighter pilots became ground attack pilots, the B-29 strategic bombers became some on occasions even close support bombers. So there's this incredible flexibility that they showed, and that really is what stopped South Korea from being completely and utterly annihilated, really.
Yeah, and the US Navy also joined the fray. And also you mentioned the short Sunderlands, so the RAF, they were quite early, they were brought quite early into the conflict, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Basically, soon after the invasion happened, the United Nations met and decided that it had to be stopped. Worth saying here that the United Nations didn't include the People's Republic of China, which was sort of, I think that's the sort of biggest population in the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And because it didn't include the People's Republic of China, the Soviet Union, which should have been there, was actually boycotting the United Nations at the time. So actually, the United Nations was America, the UK, France, and hangers-on. There was actually no proper representation, really, of the other side, which, take that what you will, but yeah, basically, as soon as that came Firstly, that released the Royal Australian Air Force 77 Squadron Mustangs, who were actually already in Japan. So they were the ideal. You know, they were a ground attack squadron and a very, very good one too. So, of course, they were suddenly allowed to go off and help stop the North Korean advance. But also the RAF or the British became involved. The problem for the British was that after World War II, there was this massive ramp down in the size of all the services at the same time as there are problems in Malaya, there are problems in Kenya, there are problems all over the empire where all the locals had said, thanks a lot, we've had enough of you, you want to get rid of you. So the RAF found itself completely stretched and didn't actually have anybody free, didn't have any units free. So the only thing they could do was to supply the Sunderlands of the Far East Flying Boat Wing. So, they pitched up. And theirs was a sort of really unglamorous, unsexy role of flying around doing the mine patrols, anti-submarine patrols, all that kind of stuff, really, you know, on dark and stormy nights and the rest of it. So the guys did a fantastic job. I mean, a whole lot of medals got handed out to them, and frankly they deserved it. That was at that stage what the RAF got to, and basically they got incorporated into the US Navy sort of maritime patrol side of things. But you mentioned the US Navy, and indeed the Royal Navy as well, but the US Navy particularly had one aircraft carrier in the Pacific at the time, and they fired it across to sit off the coast of Korea and help out. The Royal Navy sent HMS Triumph as well, which also helped out a little bit. But the thing was that the US Navy had spent spent World War II perfecting the art of two things. Firstly, island hopping, going from place to place, doing little invasions of islands, taking them out, recapturing them, and then moving on to the next one. And also having these massive sort of set-piece battles with battleships and other aircraft carriers. And and basically that was what they did. They whizzled around blue seas and fired off airplanes and fought Japanese and reinvaded islands. And suddenly we're into Korea. It was you're just basically operating as a spare airfield off the coast somewhere.
Yeah.
So it was a complete and utter change, really, for the US Navy as to how they operated and how they did things. But yeah, you're right. So the US Navy were hugely involved. The US Marine Corps got involved hugely as well. And the Royal Navy also did their bit.
Yeah. And not to put too fine a point on it, but this conflict, although, as we mentioned earlier, is almost a bit of a forgotten conflict,
yeah,
was really where a lot of tactical use of aviation came into play. You know, you mentioned the flexibility of the American forces, but they also developed the role of the forward air controller in terms of directing strikes, whether they were low level or high level. And also the way that the United States Air Force reinforced its supply lines, you know, it just became a real exercise in large-scale support and delivery of weapons from the air, which in the Second World War, of course, started that process, but it really got fine-tuned here, didn't it?
It did, absolutely, yeah, and that's right. And that's, I mean, perhaps one of the fascinating things is all these little bits that we looked at or sort of had started in World War II actually sort of, as you say, got refined. The forward air controlling bit is actually another really interesting bit, because that was where there was a massive difference between what the US Navy and Marine Corps thought on the one hand and the US Air Force thought on the other. And the US Air Force method was, you for your forward air controller, he jumped in an aeroplane. So they're using particularly the T-6, which you and I know as a Harvard, but our friends across Pond would know as a Texan. They called there the Mosquito, which is because they use these, at start off using insect call signs, but they're all known as Mosquito. And the Mosquito pilot then fly along the front line and look sort of over the other side. And if he saw something interesting sort of on the other side, he then called in air support and control the aircraft that came into very, very tightly. Right, this is the target, you know, left a bit, right a bit, there you go. And so launching from Japan initially and then later on from Taegu, which is just to the west of Busan, the fighter bombers would get airborne in kind of pairs, would turn up, check in, and he'd tell them what to do, and he'd spend 5 minutes with a pair. They'd work the area, work the target, and go home. The next lot would appear. So that was the USAF method, and it became a bit of a slick machine. The US Navy and Marine Corps worked differently, largely because of the way that they had the way that they worked together fighting in World War II. So when you pitch up on some little atoll, as a Marine Corps, you don't have any artillery. So what you've got are airplanes. So the airplanes are there as your artillery. And secondly, when you're fighting the enemy that's 50 yards away, then you call in the airstrike, as opposed to the USAF thing of, well, somebody's on the far side, a couple hundred yards away. And also, rather than having somebody in the air above you, you had somebody actually with you in the front line. So the Marine Corps Navy thing was, you had a whole lot of airplanes upstairs, and you called them in one by one, and they would attack a target that was that you were already fighting. So you'd be in contact with troops maybe 30 yards away, and you'd call in the air support to come and help you there. Whereas, as I mentioned, that you could get airborne from Japan or Taigu in pairs and fly off and then pitch up and talk to the forward air control, the mosquito guy. On an aircraft carrier, you had a choice. You could either launch aircraft or you could land them. So what you did was you launched 40 of them, and then 2 hours later, you landed them. You all have left. And so when it first started, the US forward air, the USAF forward air controller was there and expecting two people to turn up and end up with 40. And of course, that just completely maxed out the system. So this whole system of what does forward air controlling involve, how are we going to do it, was something, these two completely different things. And that's one of the kind of lessons that came out of Korea and was never really completely solved in Korea. Became, I think, more completely solved in Vietnam, where the same sort of modus operandi operated, and nowadays is everybody sings from the same hymn sheet. But you're right, that's close air support at that stage was something that where it started coming together, where it started being perfected.
Hi, it's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. New Zealand's a very aviation minded country, and we have a diverse range of stories out there to tell. The Wings Over New Zealand show brings you all sorts of stories, such as interviews with pilots or ground crew, World War II veterans, post-war Air Force personnel, air show stories, historians, authors, warbird restorers, airline stories, recreational flyers and home builders, agricultural aviation such as top dressing, and a lot more. We've got an extensive archive that you can go back to and listen to all of the shows, and there are new shows coming out all the time. The Wings Over New Zealand show, bringing you New Zealand aviation stories since 2011.
Let's talk about the jets. Let's talk about the heavy metal that entered the fight, and we'll go back to the title of the subtitle of the book. What were the key aircraft that first saw service in Korea? What was their role and what sort of impact did they have?
Well, I've mentioned the F-80 Shooting Star, which is what the American units in Japan had to start with. And as I mentioned, it's a short-range airplane, and it, in getting airborne to go across to Japan and back, didn't have an awful lot of loiter time in the target area. And so very quickly they thought, well, hang on a minute, what we need to do is to have something that got more range, more loiter time. And the answer was the F-51 Mustang. So the F-80, which replaced the F-51 Mustang, was itself replaced by the F-51 Mustang, because a whole lot of the units out there ended up trading their jets in. But we digress, because we end up with F-80s and F-51 Mustangs doing most of the work and ground attack work. The war, from going back to Busan, we then have the Incheon landings, and then we have the great invasion up through North Korea. We get to the Yalu River, which point the Chinese say no, and then they come charging in, and we end up back down pretty much on the 30th parallel again. But when the Chinese got involved, the Russians were called in as well. And so the Russians ended up with a couple of regiments of MiG-15s based at Antung, which these days is called Dandong, which is right on the border, just north of the Yalu River in Manchuria. And so these jet fighters arrived, and they could protect, I mean, short-range airplanes, but they decided were there to protect that northern airspace in North Korea, where a lot of the army units were their bases and supplies, and a lot of the industrial infrastructure of North Korea was. And so they were called in, and of course jet fighters could walk all over airplanes like Mustangs and B-26s and things, and the 29s. And so at that stage, realizing that they want a bit of a loser, the USAF decided that they need to call in heavy metal, and a wing of F-86 Sabres arrived, and a wing of F-84 Thunderjets arrived. F-86, basically an air superiority fighter. F-84, actually an escort fighter. And the idea of the escort fighter was that it was designed to go miles and miles and miles and fly alongside B-29s and I guess later on B-36s and things like that, and protect them from MiG-15s, would you believe? And so the F-86 arrived. Oddly enough, it was very quickly moved for tasked for ground attack. But it was supposed to be an air-to-air fighter, but it proved itself to be woefully inadequate because at that stage, the MiG-15 and Sabre, both kind of second-generation jet fighters with swept wings, F-84 still with straight wings. And because of the performance of jet fighters, you're sitting up at sort of 40-odd thousand, 50-odd thousand feet having fights. That's where Mach numbers and compressibility and all that kind of stuff comes in. And basically, the airplanes, straight-winged airplanes like the F-80, the F-84, were completely outclassed by the MiG-15 particularly, which is able to outperform them and outfight them as well quite convincingly. So that leads to the F-86.
And Mike, the let's just go back to the MiG-15s and the entry of the Soviet Union into the into the air war. I don't know what the right way of posing the question is, but the reality was it was Chinese volunteers, big air quotes going on here, flying Soviet MiG-15s.
Big air quotes. And that's exactly what the story was that everybody believed, except for the fact that it wasn't. It was Russian, frontline Russian fighter pilots. So a lot of them very experienced. I mean, lots of really experienced World War II veterans. So we're talking quality pilots. They were flying airplanes that were painted in North Korean markings. When they first arrived, they were given a little crib sheet of this is, if you want to say, airplanes on the left or whatever it is, or, full throttle, you say, whatever it is in North Korean. Because if anybody's listening in, they can't tell. But of course, very quickly, that went out the window. And I think they just thought, sod it, we'll just speak in Russian. That was one of the big discoveries for me when I started researching this, because I started reading the National Archives. I got a lot of the reports back from USAF units and other things, because we're all sharing information. And it is apparent that the American Air Force Navy, particularly, but not necessarily CIA, believed that they were fighting exactly as you said, Chinese volunteers. With one or two Soviet instructors, whereas actually they're fighting the Soviet Air Force, and one can understand that the Soviets were very keen to play things down because they didn't want to be seen to be confronting the America, and I think the CIA / US government was very keen to keep that quiet as well. So everybody who was involved on the US side really did believe and wasn't told otherwise that they were fighting the Chinese, but they weren't. They were fighting Russians.
Right. So let's cut to the chase then. First jet versus jet kill, there are two things. The first suggested jet by jet kill, but there's also the first confirmed jet on jet kill as well, isn't there? Because it wasn't clear whether the initial kill was confirmed as anti-aircraft fire or not.
Yeah, well, there's a story to this, because actually there are three different events that could be the first air-to-air kill. And the first one, as you mentioned, is basically Senior Lieutenant Komich, who's flying along, and he is flying along at umpteen thousand feet. He looks down, he sees a formation of 10 F-80s on their way to bomb something, and he comes swooping down, and he claims a kill, and one of the F-80s is lost. And when the F-80s land, they say, "Oh, we're missing one," and say, "Well, he must have been shot down by anti-aircraft fire." Yeah. And we didn't see anybody else.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So now, I mentioned earlier on that I'd done a bit of flying at Chivna when I was instructing on the Hawk. Hawk, about the same size probably as a MiG-15. And I know from my own experience that if you come whistling down from 10,000 feet to somebody who's flying along at low level and they're desperately working hard trying to navigate, find a target and, you know, the rest of it, you get in, get the shot and be out of there without them even knowing. And I suspect that that's what happened, but we don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the next thing is there's another fight, and this time we've got an F-80 flying around who ends up in combat with a bunch of F-80s and a bunch of F-15s MiG-15s bump into each other, and a guy called Lieutenant Brown gets some shots off on Lieutenant Sanin, and so what Brown sees is he fires some shots, he registers some hits, Sanin's airplane drops vertically with smoke pouring out of it, and just before it gets to the ground, he sees it disintegrate, and then it just disappears. And so he gets, right, I shot that one down. But what happened was, as always, is, so he got some shots, and he certainly hit Sanin's MiG, and one of the shots went through one of the external fuel tanks. And Sanin realized there's a MiG behind, an F-80 behind him, and that he was not in a good position. So he thought, right, I'm going to disengage from here. So he pulled over and went into a vertical dive downwards. Now, if you put a hole in a fuel tank, it all comes out as a vapor. And so what happened was he plummeted earthwards with this plume of fuel vapor coming out, which Brown thought was smoke. It was actually just white vapor coming out of it. Just there was a day where it was one of those winter days. I'm trying to say winter, sort of autumny days, I think, wintry days with a big inversion, which keeps all the haze down, you know, sort of 10,000 people, whatever it is. And so as he came down, he thought, well, I'll get rid of these fuel tanks. So he punched his tanks off. And so these silver tanks sort of floated away suddenly from the airplane at about the same time that he went through the inversion layer into the sort of below the haze layer. So he disappeared from view from above. So that's actually what happened. He then landed his airplane, said to Igor, the ground tradesman, look, mate, there's some holes in this airplane. Can you patch it up? Which Igor said, certainly can. And then, you know, have a cup of coffee. And when you come back, it'll be sorted, which is what happened. And so he, you know, got it back in his airplane and off he went again. So the question is, well, was it shot down? Well, you know, it was hit, but I don't think that it was actually shot down. A few days later, Lieutenant Commander Amen did actually shoot down. He was flying an F9F Panther.
Yep.
And he shot down a guy called Captain Grashchev. And that is confirmed by both sides. So that's the first one that's confirmed by both sides as actually being the first genuine air-to-air kill. But I think you look in most history books, it says Brown. Unless you're Russian, in which case
yeah. And that's one of the great things about the book, actually, Mike, is the detail of all the engagements that you were able to research. You know, it almost feels like you crossed almost everyone off, and it is chronological. So for those of us who want to understand how it unfolded, you've managed to get a real level of detail behind that. Was that really hard to research and find all that data and then compile it into that sort of timeline?
First of all, I mean, I'm a bear of little brain, so I have to put things in a timeline that I can follow. I mean, one of the things I've got here is I've got the USAF official history, which bounces around all over the place and actually is therefore quite difficult to follow because you can't see what's contemporaneous. But yeah, there's an awful lot of reading around, I have to say, and going through various books and bits and pieces. There's some quite good books by Russian guys. Again, all the books that are written are very biased, shall we say, and you have to take things with a pinch of salt. Interestingly enough, I've had some quite interesting contacts by email with a guy called Igor Sidov, who's written a fantastic book. It's called The Red Devils Over the Yalu, and it's basically a very detailed account of all the Soviet units that operated over there. And there's some other guys, Tupsakayev and Krylov, who've written some other books which again go into great detail. And the thing that they were able to get into the Russian or Soviet archives, which were opened in the 1990s, and I was amazed at the level of detail that, that the Soviets went into. So to claim a kill, you had to have it on film, and you had to have a witness, and you had to write a report on what happened in great detail, and they had to find the wreckage. So,
wow.
But, I mean, but even so, and we can talk about claims and overclaim and the rest of it, there were still lots of overclaims. But I was really impressed with the amount of detail these got into. And so whereas the US Air Force records are actually, they're kind of, I think they're basically very, very chaotic because it was a forgotten war and everybody was really quite embarrassed by the whole thing. They're kind of like, I think everything, all the paperwork got shoved in a big box somewhere and it's sitting in a box somewhere in Montgomery, Alabama or whatever. But nobody's really had the time or effort to go through it and put it back into order or check through it. So there is stuff around.
Yeah.
But and again, had the COVID thing not kicked off, I might have had the ability to go and have a look. But yeah, so but it, again, it's drawing all these accounts in, sort of working out what they've written as to, or looking beyond what they've written to think, well, what actually happened, and trying to tie things together, particularly when, you know, two different accounts of exactly the same thing don't actually fit.
Yeah.
You think, well, hang on.
Yeah.
And how could this fit? So there's a slight bit of conjecture on occasions. But what I tried to do was to get as much detail as I could and to try and give everybody's side of the story so that you got the full, you know, so as a reader, you get a full picture without being biased, without sort of predisposing you to one view or another. So yeah, that's the aim of the game, really.
Well, let's come back to the story and come back to our jets again. F-86 enters the fray along with the F-84, the Thunder jets.
Yeah.
And we hear a lot about MiG Alley as well.
Yeah.
How did the air war then unfold with all these super fast fighters appearing on the scene?
Well, we always tend wars because MiG Alley, which you've already mentioned, is basically it's the northwest corner of North Korea. The Soviets are based mainly in Antung, Dandong, and there's at the beginning of the war, there's one airfield. Eventually, they build lots more, and eventually, you end up with I think four airfields in that area, which are all known as the Antung complex. But there's also a further, so 100 miles to the northwest of that, there's Laoyang and Anshang, where there's other airfields. And the MiG Alley is sort of almost drawn as a, you know, if you draw a sort of arc, which covers the range of the MiG-15, and that's not massive. It's only about 70 odd miles from Antung,
right,
where the guys would get airborne without drop tanks, could climb and get to a position. So you're talking, so basically runs along the Alu River, and then so North Korea is, or certainly the west coast of Korea is cut by these east-west flowing rivers. And the next one down from the Yalu, about 70 miles south of it, is the Chongcheong River. And basically, MiG Alley was the bit between those two on the western side, drawing a sort of 70-mile arc around Antung.
Right, okay.
And so in there, there's this massive air-to-air war going on with MiG-15s who... And their interest in life is not shooting down Sabres, but actually in shooting down B-29s, B-26s,
yep.
F-80s, airplanes that are coming to bomb the various bits of infrastructure there.
Yeah, because the ground forces, Mike, are pushing back now, aren't they? The South is fighting back predominantly with heavy US support, but
yeah,
you know, with United Nations support as well, you know, ourselves, the Australians were heavily involved, South
yeah.
Africans
yeah.
were heavily involved as well, but conditions were dreadful, you know.
Yeah, they were.
You know, we didn't, I did mean to ask you in the beginning, actually, one of the massive effects and the challenges that both ground forces but also air forces had to deal with was the terrain and the weather, and it worked against everyone, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. The everyone except for the North Koreans, the Chinese and North Koreans, sort of trying to resupply themselves. Yeah.
Basically,
Korea, it's about the same size as the UK, roughly speaking, from north to south and probably from east to west as well. It's got big hills in, on the eastern side of it. And as I mentioned, on the western side of it, it's got these sort of east-west flowing rivers that that cut across it. In the winter, it is basically the winds blow off Manchuria. So you end up with these really cold, clear winds. So you end up with freezing cold conditions, which incidentally jet engines love. And you also end up with really clear air. So winter periods, freezing cold, so not very nice for guys on the ground. But in terms of flying airplanes, fantastic, because you get extra power out of it. And in terms of flying and fighting, fantastic, because you've got this lovely clear skies that you can go off and take names and kick ass and do your thing. In the summer, however, you've got the sort of southwesterly monsoon that blows in with really sort of really wet, moist air, and so massive clouds everywhere. And because you've got mountains on the right hand side, most of it's sitting, the cloud tops are sitting on the hill. So if you're a mud moving pilot trying to find a target down a valley, you've got this, you really are flying in to the absolute limits. And more than a few people came very horribly unstuck and flew into hills and all the rest of it as well as they tried to get through. So you're right. I mean, it does. And the other thing, of course, about this sort of northwesterly prevailing wind at height was, if you're in your F-86 having a punch up with MiGs, the wind was going to blow you home. So you could lurk a little bit longer, and lots of guys did. And it was not unknown. In fact, it has happened probably about sort of once a week or twice a week that guys would actually run out of fuel, would glide back all the way sitting on the 100 knot wind, and then do a dead stick landing back into it, particularly when the airfields were up near Seoul around that area, would glide back and land dead stick landing. It's quite a regular thing, apparently.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
The war was, it was quite drawn out. It was particularly for the ground forces, with that weather, it was hard going. It was a big old slog. And one of the challenges that I found quite interesting to read about was how the different cultures, the different air forces, rotated their crews, because they became battle weary. But they were very... there were interesting cultural differences, weren't there, in how those air crews were rotated. The Chinese and the Soviets, went full squadron with its own challenges, which maybe you could explain to us. But the Americans took a different route, and that was more mission-based, wasn't it? And quite interesting how they affected the flying and the air war going forwards.
Yeah, well, the American system, which was a great success, actually, was they decided early on that what they do is, instead of putting whole units in and out, which was that they actually cycle people through. So you pitch up, you'd fly your tour of 100 missions with whichever squadron it was there, and then you go back home again. And that worked really well, because you ended up with a continuous supply of people going through. And it meant that when you arrived as the newbie, there were people there who were just leaving having done 100 missions, and people who'd done sort of everything in between. And so there was... all the experience that was learnt was passed on. And so there was a continuous improvement, I guess you could say, in quality, and as the corporate memory kind of learnt the lessons and didn't forget them. The Russians, on the other hand, or Soviets, took the opposite view, and they would rotate units in, and then at the end of their tour, they'd take everybody out and put a new one in. And the Americans noticed the difference. So you end up this cyclical thing of you'd end up with a really good unit, and suddenly it would all change, and suddenly you'd end up with people who weren't very good at all, and you'd see them get better and better, and then and then they'd go away, and then the next lot would come. So the Soviet system didn't, it was good, I guess, in terms of everybody knew each other on a unit, so for unit sort of pulling together was good. However, the major loss really is you never end up this corporate memory. So you know, lessons were relearned from scratch. And particularly, as I say, when they started, there were these massively experienced fighter pilots, and towards the end, they were putting regiments in. Now, I think one was it was an air defence regiment, not from the Russian Air Force, but from the Russian Air Defence Network. So these were interceptor pilots who were suddenly there doing, you know, air combat, close air combat. So you know, that was a big difference. The Chinese now. I've mentioned how the Chinese started from nothing and ended up with these sort of, I can't remember how many, it was something like 10 divisions of a massive number of but one of the things that I mean, it's really, really quite canny, I think, the way the Chinese played this was one of the lessons learned in World War One, I think by Richthofen or someone like that, and then relearned every war since, particularly by the Americans in Vietnam, is that if you most people are lost in the first 10 missions, and this is the everybody doubtless heard of Exercise Red Flag out in Nevada, which was born of the Vietnam War, where you fly 10 missions, and those are as realistic as they can be, so that when you pitch up to war, actually you've already done your 10, so you're going to survive a bit longer. And the Chinese, I think, took a very similar view and thought, right, we've got all these guys who have only just learned to fly MiG-15, but they know nothing. And what we need to do is to get some combat experience. And so what they did was they cycled their units through very quickly. So almost, so you start from nothing in 1949, but by 1953, you've got however many divisions of MiG-15 pilots, all of whom have done at least 10 combat missions.
Fascinating.
We laugh at them, but actually they were playing the long game, and they actually had I think they knew what they were doing. And the Chinese Air Force is that's one of the surprises that came out of this whole thing. You know, they didn't play a massive role in it, but they really did use it well. I think use the opportunity well, shall we say?
Yeah. And let me go back to the jets.
Can't let go.
We briefly mentioned the F-86, the Sabre, but let's not forget the Gloster Meteor. Tell us how that entered the fray and what role it undertook.
Yeah, so the Americans doing very well with the Sabre. Sabre and MiG-15 very well matched, very similar in performance. MiG-15 probably has the edge of the performance, but there we go. And so the Australians, who have been flying F-51 Mustangs and doing a fantastic job, this very well-respected unit, 77 Squadron, and they think, well, we need to get into this jet fighter business. So they said to the Americans, why don't you let us have some of your Sabres? To which the Americans said, no, we haven't got any. We need them all ourselves. So being lent on by the good old Brits, the Australians approached the British, who said, yeah, we've got a lot of these Meteors. They're fantastic. You should have these. And so the Australians, I think, rather got saddled with the Gloster Meteor F-8, which was in its own way and a fine enough airplane, but it wasn't a dogfighter. Now, here's the thing. So we've got this fantastic and very professional and very well-respected ground attack squadron flying F-51 Mustangs. They then very quickly re-equip with the Meteor, and they think they'll have a bit of action on the air-to-air side of things. We're fighter pilots now. The only problem was that A, the airplane was completely unsuitable, and B, none of the pilots on the squadron at the time had any air-to-air experience. So you can see where this thing can't be. So it all ended in tears, I'm afraid, and the 77 Squadron did not do very well to start with. And then the new boss came in to the squadron, and he said, this is ridiculous. We need to go back to what we know about and what the airplane will do very well. And although the Meteor hadn't been designed as a ground attack aircraft, it was actually very, very good, very stable weapons platform, and built of like all British airplanes that are built of milled steel, and with two engines as well. So it was a fantastic rocket platform. And so, and what the one of the weapons, and we haven't gone into this, I know, really, but one of the big weapons that was used so much in Korea was napalm. But to drop napalm from an airplane, from a Mustang, for example, it's in a tank thing, and you have to fly very low and quite slow over the target, and you're quite vulnerable dropping it. The Australians found that if they got the standard British rocket, and took out the high explosive, you could stick an awful lot of napalm in it. And what you then ended up with was this sort of, a napalm rocket, which had a massive standoff range. So you could actually deliver this stuff, from a safe distance. And so, and that's what 77 Squadron specialised in. The Meteor was not a very good gun platform because it was so stable, and to try and track within gun range, it's quite short, wasn't very good. But in the longer standoff range with rockets on, it was fantastic machine. So again, it's a case of the right airplane, but also the right experience of your pilots as well.
Yeah.
And then the NGO, the squadron came out very well, and the Meteor came out of it quite well as well, for all that. But it didn't do very well as an air-to-air fighter.
No, sadly. I could go on forever talking about these, Mike. Sure. There's some great stories in the book, and we probably don't have time to go into many of them. But, there's one I particularly picked out was the rescue of the African-American U.S. Navy pilot, Ensign Jesse Brown. Amazing story. So you've got to get the book to read about that.
I shouldn't be saying this because I'm trying to promote my own book, but there's actually, I think there's another book, and I can't remember what it's called now, but by an American guy, and I think it's coming out as a film as well. And it's exactly about this. And just to let people know the story. So this guy, Jesse Brown, he's the first African-American to join the U.S. Navy, qualifies as a pilot on the squadron, and is a very close friend with a guy called Hudner. And these two guys are really close buddies, and they go off and on this one mission supporting the U.S. Marines as they're withdrawing from the Chosin Reservoir. Brown gets shot down and crash lands his airplane, and his mate, who's flying around, looks at it and thinks, I've got to get him out of there. So he actually then crash lands next to him in his own airplane, wrecks that, jumps out, goes to get Jesse out of the airplane. But Jesse's actually stuck because the airplane's collapsed around him. He's actually pinned to it. A helicopter arrives, and the helicopter crew gets out, and the two of them are cutting away at that, trying to get Jesse out of this airplane. And they realize they can't do it, and the thing's about to catch fire. So, It's all very sad, but again, the efforts that the guys went to and that kind of comradeship and the rest of it. So it is a fantastic story. So to see it in perspective of the whole war, yes, get my book. And there's another one floating around if you enjoy that. If you want to read more about it, and a film Dallas to watch in the near future as well.
I for example didn't know that Buzz Aldrin had flown for the US forces. He had a MiG-15 kill. You cover that as well, don't you?
Yeah, I think he might have got a couple. I think the one that we refer to that is there was a stage, and I think there were many Chinese pilots who, when it all got too difficult, or I think particularly as they manoeuvred the MiG-15, which was prone to spinning if you didn't know what you're doing, and I think if it started spinning, they just jumped out, and so I think he closed in to take the kill, and there's a bit of gun camera film of this guy just jumping out of the airplane in the ejection seat.
Wow. No, it's fascinating stuff. Just digress a little bit away from jets for a bit. Tell us about the role of helicopters, because this was really the first conflict where they also came into play as well, wasn't it?
Well, that's right. Yeah, it's again one of those fascinating facets of this Korean War. So many different bits and pieces, and one of it is, of course, as you say, the helicopter. And here I have to admit that there is a bit of a I made a spelling error on the HO3S helicopter, and a couple of times I've noticed it, like you do, you read a book, oh no, and I've written there's HOS3, and I'm thinking, oh no, someone's going to spot that, and they're going to mark. But yeah, so this is it's also called the H3, a little thing. I think the Western Dragonfly was the British version of it. This is the first airplane that's kind of viable for, you can take two or three people in it. So they're using it for rescues, and there's some fantastic, I think there's a rescue that I've written about in there where this HO3S with one pilot and a doctor goes flying off into North Korea to pick up a British Sea Fury pilot who's crash landed and I think broke his back. And there are all these stories. So the helicopter came into its own really for that, but also bigger airplanes, the H-19 Chickasaw, which is, again, I think in British terms, that's like a Westland Whirlwind. Was a version of it, which can actually carry a few troops and that. And so these things were used both for rescues, for carting troops around, for carting supplies up to the front line, particularly when because from 1950, middle of 1950 onwards, it was like World War One, you know, big trenches and God knows what else. So, carting stuff up, particularly casualty evacuation as well from the front lines. All these things that, that helicopters were used to and came into their own, because they actually did have the performance to do something useful for the first time.
So, no,
yeah, there's a whole story about helicopters there, which again I've kind of mentioned, but I haven't gone into great detail on. But again, putting it kind of in perspective, as it were.
I think what you were able to do, Mike, was really so into the story how each of those aircraft, and we've really light touched on the whole of the conflict there, but you've done a fabulous job of weaving in the detail. But I am, just before we come back to summarize what I have to go a little way back to ask you about something I was absolutely fascinated by, and that was the PO7, the Night Heckler, and the use of that by the PO2, Northern Forces. Just tell us very briefly about that before we wrap up.
Yeah, so the PO2 is the kind of the Russian equivalent of the Tiger Moth, and it looks, as somebody said to me, looks like an Avro 504 that's been put together backwards. It's a tiny little thing, and it was used by there was a regiment of Soviet women in World War II, and they flew this thing. They're called the Night Witches. They used to fly over the German lines and throw bombs out. And when the North Korean Air Force, which we talked about right at the beginning, basically got its comeuppance, because it was small, and it very quickly got completely annihilated by the USAF when the USAF started putting numbers of aircraft in, and they decided to resort instead to kind of guerrilla tactics and leave the big fighting to the Russians. And so they got these little PO2 things and would just potter across at night and then fly around Seoul or fly around the airfields, the USAF airfields, and just drop, they'd have a whole lot of bombs in the back cockpit and just throw them out. And so these things would arrive every night at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning and really, do a little bit of damage, not much damage, but really upset people, because it was, like a mosquito buzzing around you. It will hurt you if it hits you, but yeah. And the really frustrating thing was that they had all this sort of modern technology of radar-laid guns and night fighters and GCI controllers and the rest of it, and they just couldn't get these guys because they were going so slowly. Because the thing was made of canvas and wood, it didn't show up on radar. So there were a couple of guys obviously they did eventually get techniques tuned down, but there were a couple of airplanes certainly that were lost trying to intercept these things, because they came in and they had so much, in a jet fighter, so much overtake that when they opened fire, the next thing that happened was they actually, clocked the thing, flew into it, and that was both airplanes down. So, these airplanes proved themselves to be really, really irritating, really a sort of morale sapper. And probably very good use of air power, really. Very, very, very cheap. Great amount of effort, for very little effort, should I say?
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian, a compact format quarterly journal. The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
Just one other point I just wanted to ask you about, Mike, was some of your research also brought some fabulous stories and brought to light the role of RAF pilots who flew the F-86. I think they flew the F-86E, didn't they?
Yeah, even the A as well. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yes, and that was, as I kind of mentioned right at the beginning, was how I got into it all, was through beginning to research these guys and suddenly realizing there are all these stories. So there were guys who, firstly, who were on exchange tours out in the States, and they then were cycled through like all pilots in the USAF. So when their turn came off, they went, and a whole lot of guys did that. There were some who flew the F-86, as we mentioned, some flew the F-84, Then there were a couple of guys also who Peter Wickham Barnes and Johnny Johnson, two really well-known fighter pilots who were called in right at the beginning of the war. Actually, the Americans being one of the things that's interesting about America is that people don't. We tend to be very parochial about thinking about things, and if we didn't invent it and we didn't think of it, we think it's crap. But they tend to think, well, what if we want to know things? Well, what does everybody else think? Let's see what everybody's thought so far, and let's get the best, the best opinion, or the best practice. And that's exactly what they did when things when it kicked off. They wanted some advice, particularly on night intruder flying. So they said, well, who knows about that? RAF, we'll get them in. And so Peter Wickham Barnes was called in, and was they said, right, tell us what you know. So there were a couple of these two guys who came in for that, but also then the RAF managed to arrange for teams of four pilots from the Central Fighter Establishment to do combat tours. So they were invited to go and join the American squadrons and do a full tour on the F-86 they went to. And four groups of four guys did that, and their reports are written formed the basis of a lot of my research. There were also, as I did the reports from the exchange guys as well, and Johnson and Wickham Barnes. They also, the Air Force offered, and the Americans said, yes, we'll take it, offered, and I can't remember how many pilots it was now, but it's something like 20 guys to fly with the as volunteers to join the USAF squadrons, and that occurred right in the sort of last probably sort of late 1952 onwards. So guys would pitch up and join the squadrons, and at the same time the or probably a little bit earlier than that, actually, the Australian Air Force, being quite a small organisation, started running out of pilots that were cycling through Korea. So they asked for volunteers, and so a whole lot of volunteers, and again, 20 to 30 guys, I think, probably maybe possibly a bit more than that, flew tours with the Royal Australian Air Force flying the Meteors. It's some interesting stories back from that as well. So there were, I think, and it's at the back end of the book, I wrote them all down in one of the appendixes, which is all the guys that I could find who had flown tours of one sort or another with the American Force. That includes a couple of guys flying B-29s, two crews that flew the Sky Knight Night Fighter as well. All in there. So yeah, there was, and that was the big surprise to me about the whole Korea War thing, was actually, although the RAF wasn't kind of officially involved, it did actually play quite a bit. I mean, 70 guys, that's the equivalent of sort of four or five squadrons worth of people being deployed out there doing the work over 3 years. So it was quite a commitment, really, for the RAF, and they did a good job. I mean, we also lost a few. There's a good few guys killed out there, but also they were very well respected by the US guys as well, and the Australians as well. Really did respect those guys who went there, and I thought they're good operators.
Interesting stuff. Mike, two questions from my colleague, Tim Robinson. Question number one, I think we might have covered some of this, but I'll ask it anyway. The United States Air Force claimed that the F-86 Sabre pilots enjoyed a superior kill ratio against the MiG-15s, but more recent research has suggested it was more or less equal due to the Soviet pilots flying in secrets. What's your view on this?
Yeah, that's a fascinating point, actually. And we kept going back to jets. We've never got quite round to talking about the jet versus jet bit, but because there's so much else,
they're going to have to read it.
Yeah, they're going to have to read it. Yeah. Interestingly, James Jabara, who was the first jet fighter pilot ace, he gave a lecture at the British Central Fighter Establishment, I think, in 1952, and he said that in an interview, the in air-to-air combat, they were losing it was losing one Sabre for every MiG they shot down. He reckoned it's probably about evens, but there are a couple of things. There are three things. That's a couple, three amongst the things are. So thing number one, do you compare a kill rate between Sabres and MiG-15s? And it's a bit like comparing apples and pears, because the Sabre was there to shoot down MiG-15s, full stop, end of story. That's it. The MiG-15, as I mentioned earlier on, was there to shoot down B-29s, B-26s, F-80s, F-51s, Meteors, yeah. F-84s, blah, blah, blah. So you have to realise that it was, they were looking at something completely different. You
know, yeah, the roles were different,
Yeah. So, you know, okay, they might have only shot down 10 Sabres, but they also shot down, you know, all these other things.
Yeah.
And take that into account. Now, there are two other points as well. So I would say that, you know, I think that in Russian hands, in air combat, in the big blue sky, that they were pretty even. But firstly, there was a rule because the Russians were operating out of China. The Americans were not allowed into China. They weren't allowed to cross the Yalu River. So airplanes, Russian airplanes would go, thank you very much. I'm going to disengage. I'm going to go home now. And they'd nip across the river and they couldn't be, yeah, they were safe. So realizing that this probably wasn't tactically, politically it had to be done, but tactically it wasn't very sound, the Americans changed the rules. They said, well, if you're in hot pursuit, then you may follow the airplane. And this was where things got, what's hot pursuit? And what we ended up doing was people, and in the end, it ended up with a thing that they called hawking, which was actually going across and flying around in circles, waiting for someone that you could hotly pursue as they started off down the runway. And a large number of MiG-15s kills claimed by the kind of aces towards the end of the war were actually killed in the circuit in one of the airfields at Antung.
So
they would have killed more MiGs than Sabres than that. But again, is that a fair balance if you're trying to sort of measure how well they're balanced in terms of air combat? There again, you say, as I said, well, of course, the MiGs are shooting B-29s and B-26s down as well. So perhaps that all evens out. And again, that probably evens out in the wash. And the final factor was the Chinese that we kind of mentioned. So guys were being cycled through with not much experience and were probably not terribly au fait with A, the airplane, B, air combat, C, in a big sky, and I've been there myself, it's very easy just not to see anything. You could quite happily fly through the middle of a huge, great dogfight and not even see anybody. So it wouldn't surprise me if quite a few of the guys with not much experience did exactly that. But also the Chinese, I think, were very sensible and very aware of their own limitations. And unless they knew they were going to win or they had a very good chance of winning, they would not engage. They would just go, they'd fly past.
Yeah.
So you end up with them probably not scoring that many kills, but probably being quite a few of them being taken down. So you end up with a slightly different picture there because suddenly we probably do have more MiGs than Sabres being shot down, but for different reasons. But I go back I share the view of the old James Jabara, and I suspect that the MiGs and Sabres were very evenly matched and their losses were pretty much even as well, I would think.
Right. Okay. And then final question from Tim. What was your biggest surprise in research in the book?
all of it. that's a brilliant question. And I honestly, I don't think I can answer it because it's like every corner I turned, there was another surprise there. And we talked PO2, for example, little biplane thing. We talked about suddenly discovering all these 70 guys from the RAF who were doing their thing. We suddenly discovered the Russians were there, and and also looked into air combat between MiGs and Sabres. Huge amounts, and again, the way that air power is used, and the way that one of the again really just fascinating things is how the interdiction campaigns, which there are various ones, failed. And the reason they failed was because nobody realized quite how ingenious the North Koreans and the Chinese were. So they go down and take out a bridge and then come back the next day and the bridge had been rebuilt. where you see there's the bridge has been taken out, but they built one next door to it. It's nothing to do with flying and the rest of it, but I suppose it is to do with targeting and things. But things like that, there's just so many little bits and pieces that are just utterly amazing. The Korean War is just full of all these tiny little corners and anecdotes and facets, and every one is fascinating and is surprising in its own way. So I'm afraid that's a rather pathetic answer to your question.
No, it's a great answer, and I think what that really says, Mike, is that the passion for the subject really comes through in you talking, and we've only dusted the top of the surface.
Oh, we have
so much more that I wanted to talk about, but time's probably got the best of us.
Yeah, I think it
now
has.
So we'll probably leave it there and leave a little bit left for the reader. It is a fabulous book, 320 odd pages, a picture on a page, as I said earlier, published by Osprey. But more importantly, Mike, how can our listeners find out about you online if they want to engage, ask you any questions or anything like that? Where can they find you on social media?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It is Michael Napier. I think it's Michael with several numbers, but if you look at Michael Napier, I think there's another one who's a QC. So obviously somebody very clever with my name, but I'm the thick one. But yeah, so I am on Twitter. And I'm also, I've got a Facebook page, Michael Napier Author, which is, contact me through those. So yeah, I'm delighted to answer any questions people have. And as you probably gather, it's become a bit of a passion for me.
Yeah.
This whole thing.
Now, you've also got a Twitter feed based on the book as well, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. Because I started off doing that, and then the publisher says, no, you should have a proper author one. So I kind of, I'm running that. But yeah, I do log into both. So there is, if you look up Korean Air War, there's a Twitter feed there as well.
And I'll put links to all of those in the show notes as well for you, Mike.
Oh, thanks, Peter. That's very kind of you.
Okay, that's about it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. And we'd also like to thank the extended family of supporters. That is, of course, Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club, and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence. Okay, you can find me on the internet at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. And, of course, you can find Aviation Extended on our Twitter and Facebook pages. I'll put links to Ellie, Tim and Gareth. All apologies from those for not being able to join us today. They've missed a great show. Really, really enjoyed talking to you, Mike. I genuinely found the book fascinating. It's a topic I knew very little about. A bit like you said earlier, unfortunately, I'm a bit of an airbrain. But as I said, the book is a great reference source, so you can use it as a reference book. You can pick it up. There's some fabulous photos. We'll put some of those in the show notes as well. So thanks so much for joining us today, Mike.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks very much indeed for having me. As you probably gather, I do enjoy talking about the subject at great length.
No, really, really enjoyed it. But that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.